The gospel reading this morning follows last week's Easter reading from the Gospel of Matthew, known as the Report of the Guard. These verses are not often read in worship. They reflect the concern of Matthew's community several decades after the resurrection, that some denied the Easter story by claiming that Jesus' body had been stolen, from the 28th chapter, beginning with the 11th verse. While they were going, some of the guard went into the city and told the chief priests everything that had happened. After the priests had assembled with the elders, they devised a plan to give a large sum of money to the soldiers, telling them, "You must say, his disciples came by at night and stole him away while we were asleep. If this comes to the governor's ears, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." So they took the money and did as they were directed, and this story is still told among the Jews to this day. Here ends the reading. May these words encourage us not to cheapen our faith or to sell the gospel story short. Amen.
Creation justice. That was kind of a new phrase for me, creation justice, not just creation care. It's not enough just to care for the earth, but the earth demands justice. And as people of faith, God demands that we advocate justice for all who are vulnerable, including the earth itself. How did we get here? How did we get to this point where our society is so fractious, so fractured, so in conflict with one another? How did we get to this point where it seems like we have gone too far down the path and we wonder whether it was too late to turn back? Speaking of paths, as I was preparing this sermon earlier in this week, I went for a long walk, as I often do. I've learned to call this a peripatetic process. Have you heard that word before, peripatetic? It means done while walking. I try to make it peripatetic rather than peripathetic. But you can be the judge of that. This time I went for a walk in Regal Ranch Park, which is just walking distance from here. I just turn left on the road, and I just keep walking, and there I am. And you may know this if you've gone walking there recently, that it's not the dry creek bed that it used to be. When I first got here in the summer, it was all dry. I wondered whether anything ever flowed in that bed. Now it's all flowing on the paths. And I had tried to walk down these paths before, and I had gotten to the point where I'm like, I can't go any further without getting mud all over my shoes. But this time I was determined. It was beautiful out. I wanted to keep walking. And I thought to myself, I am just going to keep walking, one foot in front of the other, until I get to that moment when I can't take one more step before mud and water just filling my shoe. And I'm happy to say I was able to make it quite a ways. The bottoms of my shoe, just the edges of it, got nice and muddy. There were times when I had to jump over one part of the path and hold onto a tree and then kind of go around it and then jump across another part of the path and walk over here, and the mud was squishing and everything, but I was able to do it. I didn't go under, so to speak, with my shoes. I was wearing my kind of nice shoes. Not my Sunday nice shoes, but, you know, my Friday nice shoes. I didn't really want to get them muddy. These weren't, you know, the rubber boots that come up to your knee. These were low-top shoes that really shouldn't get very muddy, but I was determined. I was determined to continue on my walk. On the walk, and maybe you know this because you've lived in Sebastopol for a long time, there were moments when I could close my eyes and all I heard was birds. Birds, like a whole chorus of birds and all different voices. They were not in tune with one another. But they were all singing and chattering and talking about who knows what. And it just overwhelmed me. Overwhelmed me at times, the beauty of all that chatter and all of that song. Like immersing yourself in the mystery of creation itself, right there, within walking distance of here. And sun coming through leaves, and the sound of the trickle of water where there hadn't been any just 9 months ago. Gorgeous, beautiful gift. One privilege of belonging to a faith community like the church is that we get to talk about days like Earth Day, not just in political terms, but also in terms of gift. By faith, we trust that creation itself is a gift, and our job is to receive it. And our job is to play certain roles. It says it right there in Genesis, to play a caretaker role. We are called to be gardeners. That is to be our relationship with the creation that God has given as gift, to receive the gift, and now to be gardeners, to tend it. It says it right there in Genesis. If we ever wonder what our role in relationship to creation is, just go back to the very first chapter of the very first book, and it says, tend it. Take care of it. You are caretakers. Do it. That is our role. It continues to be our role. Now you may wonder what, if anything, the text that Roger read has to do with Earth Day, with Creation Justice Sunday. Let's just say that in this part of Matthew, there are two competing stories. Two competing stories. And it seems to me that in conversations, in public debate about the earth, there are at least two competing stories. One that says we are to be caretakers, and another that says, don't worry about that. The earth is to be used for human benefit. Now, I know I'm simplifying. Anytime you boil it down into two stories, there's simplification happening, but there's a tension there. And it's a tension that lives, I think, in each of our lives. Am I a consumer? Yes. Or a caretaker? Yes. How do I live out this tension? How do I make choices along the way? As my former preaching professor, the late Peter Gomes, used to say, before a preacher can preach on a text, she or he must acknowledge the stones in the road. The stones in the road are those places in the text where you go, uh-oh, what are we going to do with that? In this text that you just heard read from the 28th chapter of Matthew, these verses that follow the resurrection account, there are maybe more than this, but I've identified two stones in the road. One, you might have noticed that what Matthew is trying to do is to lay aside any claims that the body of Jesus might have been stolen. That the way this whole resurrection thing happened was really that the disciples snuck in the middle of the night, figured out a way to roll away the stone, took the body away, rolled the stone back in front, and took off with the body, and then said, oh, he's raised. He's not here anymore. And one stone in the road for me is, kind of makes sense as a rationale. I mean, we know, right, that a dead person, once you put them in the tomb and roll the stone in front, doesn't just get up and walk out or become a different kind of body who can just walk through stone. Like, the only way we would know for a body to come out of a sealed tomb is for somebody to go into the sealed tomb, unseal it, go in, take it out, seal it up again. Doesn't it seem like a pretty reasonable explanation of why there wouldn't have been a body there on Sunday morning? So we people of faith can't just say, oh yeah, that's just what happened. Ask no more questions. It's one of those critical questions that comes. How are you going to make sense that your faith is based on something that cannot be proven, cannot be repeated, and for which there are multiple witnesses in different directions? So we can't claim too much for our faith. We can't claim to know scientifically what happened, And we have to face, as Matthew is doing, those dissenters who are suggesting that your story is a little fishy about the stone being rolled away and there being no body. Maybe there's another explanation. So that's one of the stones in the road. The other stone in the road is that yet again, anti-Judaism, which later gets turned into anti-Semitism, is right there in our scripture. I wish we could just edit that part out. But it's right there. And this is one of those texts that over the past 2,000 years has been used to justify violence and hatred and ignorance toward our Jewish sisters and brothers. And the history of that in our Christian faith is something that should be lamented and repented and never forgotten. As Roger mentioned, these verses from Matthew seem to reflect a concern for Matthew and his community, a community that was starting to experience a rift between those who thought of themselves as Christians and who proclaimed the truth of the resurrection, and a rift and those who saw themselves primarily as Jewish and who did not believe in that interpretation of the resurrection. And so it seems to me that Matthew himself hasn't taken his own advice, or at least Jesus' own advice, earlier in the gospel, not to speak falsely about your neighbor, not to demonize or demean or dismiss the one who doesn't agree with you. And so here we are, left with this accusation that it's really the Jews who are circulating this story that the resurrection didn't really happen. Big stone in the road, right? And we'd like to just edit it out. Oh, let's just not read that part of it. You know, these verses aren't included in any lectionary. They're not normally preached on. It's the first time I've ever preached on these verses. But it seems to me that what Matthew's trying to say, even though he stumbles into this stone that he's placed in the road, what he's trying to say is that there are two stories. A story that will keep the community buoyant, a story of new life, a story of resurrection, a story of impossible viability of the community as they move forward. And the other story, which says, it didn't really happen. Oh, it really just ended in death. Oh, the soldiers get to have the last say. Oh, the powers that be had a little meeting on the side. Some money was exchanged, and the real story was subsumed underneath this other story, this alternative story. But Christians aren't the only ones who play with these kind of two stories. You see, the Jews, who were formerly known as the Israelites, they also had this tension between two stories. Do you know that Genesis, the book of Genesis, was probably not, scholars suggest, the first book to be written chronologically, but rather that Genesis itself was written while Israel was in exile in Babylon. I'm talking about 600 BCE. You remember the story. Babylon was the up-and-coming empire. They started flexing their muscles, threatening. There was some bad political moves on the part of Jerusalem, and Babylon came in and said, "We're done with this," and there were multiple deportations. They leveled the city, and they deported not everybody, but the elites of Jerusalem, the rich, the educated, the priests, deported them all the way to Babylon. And there in Babylon, those elites, they actually had a pretty good life. They weren't made slaves. The Babylonians were more interested in making them members of society, assimilation, acculturation. And so you could imagine it like this. All of the Israelite parents would send their Israelite children off to Babylonian school. It was the public school. And among other things, the Israelite children would go off to the school and they would learn about what the Babylonian creation myth was. Have you heard the name of it before? Enuma Elish? I'm looking out at least one seminary grad who's heard of it before. The Enuma Elish is the Babylonian creation story. It was the dominant creation story at the time. And what it said was that the whole universe came into being by an act of divine violence. The god Tiamat defeated his mother. The god Marduk defeated his mother, Tiamat. who was the goddess of chaos. He finally tamed her, defeated her, and created the earth and the heavens by dissecting her body into different pieces. And so that the creation of the earth came by this act of divine violence and dissection. Can you imagine now the Israelite parents greeting their children when they come back from Babylonian school, closing the door, gathering around the kitchen table and saying, "What'd you learn in school today?" And the Israelite children say, "Well, we learned the Enuma Elish. You'll tell us about that." Well, and they tell the story. And as the children are telling the story, the Israelite parent puts down the shades, makes sure the door is locked, and when the child is done, speaks in a hushed tone, "Come here. Let me tell you a different story. In the beginning, the Spirit of God moved over the face of the deep, and God spoke, and God created, and God looked at what God created, and God called it, you know it, good." Which story do you like better? So the Israelites, long before the Christian community, were used to hearing one story and then telling a slightly different one because it was more true to their understanding of who God was. When I was walking along the path in Regal Ranch Road, wondering when my last step would be, I got to a point where it was all mud and a puddle, and there was one little root right here along the edge where I could have kept walking. But you know what was right there on that strip? These little, darling, beautiful, yellow flowers. They looked like they had just been born that day. Just popped up and said, "Look at me. Look at this. Look at us." And I got to that point where I said, "I can take one more step." But do you know where that one more step would have landed my foot? Oh, I thought about it. Because I'd gotten to that point in the path where I could see now the dry path on the other side, and I knew exactly how to get back. I just had to take this one last stretch of path right over here in order to get there. But in order to do it, I would have had to trod on all those little yellow flowers. No one would have seen me. I would have met my goal. My shoes, they wouldn't have gotten mud or water in them. I would have just been fine. I couldn't do it. I turned around, and I made my way back, jumping over puddles all the way back. Stories. Choices. Two stories. A way of life and of creation and of caretaking. Another one of progress, maybe destruction, never looking back. But I thought to myself in that moment, this would be a good last line of a sermon. Sometimes we have to turn back and retrace our steps in order to get where we want to go.